So, again, I'm honored to be here. It's always special to be invited to the Commonwealth Club. And in case you don't know it, George Hammond is not only the organizer of the Humanities Member-Led Forum, but he's also chair of the board of Humanities, Inc. And so he and I worked closely together for a long time. I also see some members of my board here, which I find particularly frightening in case it's part of some kind of a performance review. But I'm always delighted to talk about Afriben, because when I first learned about her, she was not as well known as George has suggested tonight that she is. And she has special resonance for me and my growth as a literary scholar. So she was the first and earliest known British writer to earn her living writing. Now, it wasn't because she chose to do that and made money at it. It was because she had no other choice. And that's commonly the problem with women who don't have protectors or husbands or fathers. And so they have to learn how to write and learn how to make a living at it. So she was born in 1640, and as we know, she traversed that rowdy and bawdy period of the Restoration in England. She dedicated her life to poetry and to pleasure. And nearly 300 years later, Virginia Woolf, in her Room of One's Own in 1929, I'm sure you've heard this wonderful quote from her: "All women together ought to let flowers fall upon the tomb of Afriben," which is, most scandalously, but rather appropriately, in Westminster Abbey. For it was she who earned them the right to speak their mind. Now, I'm going to have more to say about that tomb in a little while. Why is Afriben so important to me? I'm going to take us back to 1984, when I first heard about her, when I was in graduate school. But first, I want to start with a little happenstance from just last month, when I was at the Symphony in San Francisco. And we were sitting up in the loge on the mezzanine, and it was a boutique kind of a performance. There were only about 24 musicians on the stage, and very few women. And most of the women, very few of them, were dressed in tuxedos. So I was fretting about this presentation. And I, instead of looking at the symphony as the symphony, I imagined that I was at the Restoration Theater. And out comes this gorgeous young woman in a flowing fuchsia gown. And she's the only color on the whole stage. And I thought, wow, this is the Restoration Theater where women first appeared on the stage. And here was this woman, Catherine Payne, and she had this tiny little flute, a piccolo. And she was playing Vivaldi's Piccolo Concerto beautifully. But what I was seeing was the Restoration Theater. And so while the orchestra section below me was very quiet and sedate, as the symphony requires, at the Restoration Theater, all those people would have been in the pit with all the rakes and the fops and the orange sellers and all yelling and screaming and the rakes trying to seduce the women who were on the stage for the first time. And women in the audience would have been masked, because no women of any good reputation would have been at the Restoration Theater unless she were in disguise. So there I was at the symphony, worrying about tonight. So then to 1984. When I first heard about her, and I was in graduate school. And that year, by lucky happenstance, I also discovered Lucas Mallet. Now, George asked me if I was going to mention Lucas Mallet tonight, because has anybody ever heard of her? No, I didn't think so. Well, I was in the library, and I saw this book for sale. It was called Mrs. Lorimer. Now, that's one of my names. So, of course, I picked up the book. I bought the book. And the only thing I knew about Lucas Mallet was that the book was from the 1880s, early 1880s. So while doing my research project that fall, I got bored. And instead, I just looked up Lucas Mallet, and I discovered that she was an important British woman writer from 1880 to 1930 and had been completely forgotten. There was no bibliography, even, of all her important work. And I thought, well, here's a woman who wrote all these really important books, novels mostly, and what happened to her? So I discovered that she had written daring yet important and well-received novels from 1880 to 1930, as I mentioned, and then was completely forgotten. So that got me thinking about what happens in literary history to people who, women especially, who dare to buck the norm, who dare to write something like that, and then what happens to them, both in their own time and later. And I can trace my own little private canon war to that particular experience in discovering Lucas Mallet. So then, in that same year, 1984, in a course on the Restoration comedy, a graduate student in the class said, "Why aren't we reading any plays by Afra Behn?" And I was like, "Who?" And the professor, first of all, that she even challenged the syllabus was a surprise to me. I was really a fledgling. So anyway, she challenged the syllabus. Well, we didn't read any Afra Behn that year. We didn't read any Afra Behn in the 3 years of courses that I took at that university, which was a wonderful university. And the professor that taught most of these courses for us was a wonderful professor, an expert in what we call the long 18th century, which goes from 1660 to 1830. And that's because everybody wants to teach those Restoration plays. So they start the 18th century in 1660 so that they can do that. There weren't even any Afra Behn novels in our novels courses. And the professors were still saying that Daniel Defoe was the first novelist. So my antennae went way up. And I couldn't wait to teach Afra Behn. All the time I was studying Lucas Mallet and trying to figure out, what Lucas Mallet was all about. And I wanted to know whether Afra Behn was only important ideologically, because this was a time when in feminist literary circles, scholars were trying to get a lot more women into the canon. So I wanted to know, was that the only reason that she was important? Well, for literary historical reasons alone, she was very important. She wrote the first novels. She was a very successful playwright. She was an excellent poet. And I wanted my students to be able to decide for themselves whether the plays and the novels, the big novels that I was now asking them to read, meant as much to them and were as important to them as the other really great writers that we were reading in these courses, Defoe, Fielding, Sterne, Richardson, all great fun, but not the first. Well, now a lot is known about Lucas Mallet's literary work. Her work is readily available. You can even get it on e-books, and I recommend it, which is more than can be said for Lucas Mallet, who's still mostly out of print. But much of Afra Behn's life is still shrouded in mystery. Like Cleopatra, whose legacy as a mighty warrior and leader of her people has been besmirched over eons of biased histories. See Stacy Schiff on that. Lucas Mallet and Afra Behn were both celebrated and vilified in their lifetime and later. This interests me very much. I wouldn't know about either writer unless I had stumbled over them, so to speak, in the dark. So a little about the Restoration. You probably know this already. 1642, Civil War. The theaters were closed. 1649, after years of turmoil between the Parliament and the King, Charles I is beheaded in a huge political crisis. And then the Commonwealth under Cromwell goes on until 1658 when Cromwell dies. And then Charles II becomes King of England, Scotland, and Wales in 1660. So the Merry Monarch, Charles II, reigned until his death in 1685 over a licentious and chaotic realm. I'm going to do my Marco Rubio. Would you? So, While battered by fire, plague, political and religious unrest, Restoration London burst with creative energy. Its court was vibrantly creative, and in the coffee houses. Theaters reopened, and as I said, for the first time, women appeared on the stages in roles for both men and women. Don't think that they led glamorous lives, though. These actresses were fair game for the gentlemen, the rakes and the fops. The women were objects of lust, gossip, seduction, and occasionally assault. They needed protectors, but didn't often have them. Nell Gwynn, one of the most talented of the Restoration actresses, became mistress to the king. So Aphra Behn's life spanned this period from 1640 to 1685. She died in 1689. She was born near Canterbury. Her mother was a wet nurse, Elizabeth Denham, and her father was a barber, Bartholomew Johnson. We know that in 1663, Aphra traveled to Suriname in the West Indies. That alone is amazing at the age of 23. Suriname then was an English landowner and slave colony under the British control. In 1667, the Dutch took it over in exchange for Manhattan Island. So around 1663 or 64, Aphra married a man named Behn, but she was quickly widowed, and he probably died during the plague, although I don't think people really know that yet. I'm trying to only give you the stuff that they actually have shown has validity. She was a spy. It's one of my favorite parts. Again, she's in her 20s, right? She was a lifelong royalist, and so somehow the crown sent her to Antwerp, and first Bruges. And in Antwerp, she sent coded messages back to the crown, back to London, that the Dutch were going to attack London by sailing up the Thames. And these messages apparently were completely ignored, just like Cassandra's. So in 1667, the Dutch sailed up the Thames, attacked the English fleet, and destroyed all the ships except one, which they took for ransom. So her loyalty as a spy was repaid by not being paid. And she had spent a lot of money to set herself up in Antwerp, but couldn't get home. So she had to resort to begging her family and friends, her friends, to get her back to London, where she was quickly arrested and may or may not have spent time in debtor's prison. We know she was arrested. There are differences of opinions of whether or not she actually went to debtor's prison, which was pretty common in those days if they couldn't pay their debts. So it's surprising that we know even this much about the life of Aphra Behn. Many ordinary lives lack notice in history, and dare I say, more women than men. So once I discovered my family tree, it was the father's side, my paternal side. It was 200 years of history, of a family history in America. There were no women's names on the entire 200 years of family history. So when they told me that I was the first girl in the family in 100 years, I think they really meant I was the first one they recorded. So anyway, that helped my antennae to go up even more when reading about the fragmented histories of women as detailed by those with, shall we say, more narrow perspectives. You can see Stacy Schiff again on Cleopatra. So she was the first English woman to earn her living with her pen. That we know about. As Robinson Crusoe famously said, necessity is the mother of invention. Aphra Behn, by necessity, wrote, just like 200 years later, Lucas Mallet, by necessity, wrote, because she had no other way to support us, no other honorable way to support herself. Lucas Mallet used to say it was an inward necessity And that's when she was flush and her books were very popular. Much later on, she was begging for advances for books that she would never be able to finish and died in penury. So, much of Aphra Behn's works feature the interplay of politics and sexual politics. Her first play was The Forced Marriage in 1670, and it went for 6 nights, which was a very good run, because only the first 2 nights were taken by the theater, and the rest of the receipts went to the playwright, and presumably the actors, but it was a very good run. It was a tragic comedy. Then she wrote a whole bunch of others, including, in 1676, Abdelazar, or The Moor's Revenge, which was set to music by Henry Purcell in a 1695 revival. That was a tragedy. But she excelled in comedy. In all, she produced 18 plays. John Dryden, who was the poet laureate of the age, produced 14 plays. And so we call it the Age of Dryden. The stage was dominated by amateurs at that time, generally men who had means and could dabble in playwriting. But Behn had to scramble. She was never patronized by King Charles, nor by King James after Charles. These Restoration comedies were really bawdy. The first high-profile play actually depicting sex was The Country Wife in 1675 by William Wycherley. It shocked me on first read because this really wonderfully witty character named Horner that everybody loves is busy seducing all the wives and pretending he's impotent, so all the men allow the wives to go into his rooms to see the pottery. After Ben's two-part The Rover, Show and Tell, The Rover, appeared in 1677 and 1681. It was widely performed in the 18th century, but not again until 1986, when the Royal Shakespeare Company did it with Jeremy Irons in the lead. And a year later, Christopher Reeve at the Williamstown Theater Festival. So beginning in the middle of the 1980s, these plays became very, very much produced, especially with Jeremy Irons and Christopher Reeve. So a little about The Rover. Set in 1651, the Cavaliers are all in exile, and Prince Charles, you know, has not been summoned back to England. It's set in Naples. And Will Moore is the roving rake. And he first seduces Angelica, who's a prostitute who's forced to sell herself for a month at a time, which was the custom. But she's never allowed herself to fall in love, but she falls in love with Will Moore because he's so witty. And they make vows, but he immediately breaks the vows and goes after every woman that he can possibly get his hands on. And I'm going to quote Wilmore just briefly. A virtuous woman? Why, what the devil should I do with a virtuous woman? A sort of ill-natured creature that takes a pride to torment a lover. Virtue is but an infirmity in a woman. Now, Aphra Behn makes a nuanced critique of this kind of character. He might have been modeled after Rochester, the really important poet who was also debauched, or it might have been after John Hoyle, who is a bisexual lover of Aphra Behn. It could have been anybody. Behn suffered from the double standard, as you might expect. John Dryden, I'm going to quote Dryden, exemplified this in his warning to a young woman in a letter, and this is Dryden. You, who write only for your diversion, may pass your hours with pleasure in it and without prejudice, always avoiding, as I know you will, the licenses of Mrs. Behn, of writing loosely and giving some scandal to the modesty of her sex. I confess I'm the last man who ought in justice to arraign her, who have myself been too much a libertine. Wycherley was worse. He called her Sappho, and I'm not even going to repeat what he said about her. Now, much later in the Victorian era, when all these Restoration comedies were either Baudelaireized or squelched, a critic in 1862 said this: "If Mrs. Benn is read at all, it can only be from a love of impurity for its own sake, for rank indecency. Even in her own day, Mrs. Benn's works had a scandalous reputation. It is true that this did not prevent her from attaining honorable burial in Westminster Abbey." They're all into this. "But it is a pity her books did not rot with her bones." "That they should be disinterred from the obscurity from which they have so happily fallen is surely inexcusable." So most of these plays fell down in the late 19th century. I'll just say parenthetically, Lucas Ballad had the same kind of reception in 1901. Aphra Behn was an accomplished poet. Just to mention one poem called "The Disappointment." Classical form, 140 lines, 10 stanzas, all regularly rhymed. I'm just going to read the last two lines, the last four lines. It has to do with Lysander, a shepherd, who's trying to seduce Chloris. And she swoons so that she won't know she's losing her honor. Lysander is so hot and furious that he can't sacrifice Chloris. So, at the end, he cursed his birth, his fate, his stars, but more the shepherdess's charms, whose soft, bewitching influence had damned him to the hell of impotence. So Ben was criticized for portraying desire as frankly as did her masculine, her male counterparts. Again, that double standard. She created sensual women who were agents of their own desire, even when objects of the male gaze. In Aphra Behn's work, rakes are never reformed. They're only play acting. They get the women, but the women know that they don't have much option. But the women in Aphra Behn plays are saved from the violence that's often happening in the in other plays. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. Around 1687, sex comedies like Congreve's and Behn's went out of fashion, and farce came in. Now, she was always very well attuned to audience taste, and she had already turned to fiction. She was a pioneer in short fiction, and her Orinoco, very short, Orinoco, is now widely taught and read, unlike Love Letters Between a Nobleman and His Sister of 500 pages. The first one was Love Letters Between a Nobleman and His Sister, published in three parts from 1684 to 1687. Before Robinson Crusoe, 1719, Amal Flanders, 1722. So beginning with the shocking title, Love Letters Between a Nobleman and His Sister, this epistolary novel draws readers into a world of politics and sexual intrigue, starting with the taboo of incest. The lovers are he's married to her sister, so by law it's incest. Flanders is based on Lord Grey of Werk, who plotted with the Duke of Monmouth, Charles's illegitimate son, to murder the king and King James, so that James the Catholic could never ascend to the throne. So that is all bound up in this long novel of love and political intrigue. It's also very much like The Disappointment that I just told you about, where Philander, did I say Lysander? His name is Philander, which dates way before Aphra Behn. And he has trouble with his seduction as well. And she becomes more libertine as he becomes more politically destitute. So as Maureen Duffy said in 1986, in here, in republishing Love Letters, she said, we're led to suppose that the 18th century novel sprang unmothered from the thigh of Robinson Crusoe. Now, Orinoco, or The Royal Slave, 1688, is an entirely different matter. It's working at the intersection. It's a tragedy. It's fiction. Some people think it's autobiography. It's fiction. I'm an English professor. Do not conflate the narrator with Afra Behn. It works at the intersections of race and class and genre and gender. It's very complicated and hotly debated. Only 75 pages. The first-person narrator tells a story of Orinoco, who's a royal prince from Coromantian on the west coast of Africa, who's been trading slaves himself that he has captured in battle, which is presumably an honorable way to become a slave. His beloved, Imawinda, is called to the palace to become a concubine to the 100-year-old king who, Afra Behn, he's impotent. Orinoco had snuck into the palace and made love to Imawinda. They were betrothed, and they were caught, of course, and she was sold into slavery. Very quickly after, the slave trader that he relied on, traps him, and he also ends up in Suriname as a slave. Now, he's a slave in name only, because he's royal. And so a lot of what's going on in Orinoco, the novel, is not so much about race and Orinoco's race and Imawinda's race, but about their class. These are you know, royalty. And so when the narrator and Afra Behn behind her objects to the enslavement of these people, they're objecting more to the fact that they're royal than they are, because they're not really objecting to this enslavement of the common people who've been sold as spoils of war. So the problem, well, there are many problems in this novel, but the problem for Orinoco is he's promised that he and Imawinda will be sent back to Africa because they are royalty. And it takes a while for Orinoco to figure out that all the English are untrustworthy. And Afra Behn draws this parallel with the native Indians in Suriname, Caribs, who are peaceful and modest and not enslaved at all, and they trade with the English, but the English are terrible. So the thing is that Afra Behn spectacularizes Orinoco as a English-speaking, French-speaking African prince, so that the readers are troubled by the way that Afra Behn has treated the characters in this play. And so the real issue is she abolitionist? And I can tell you that some of the details in this short novel are pretty gruesome. And so it's hard not to say that she is really decrying slavery. Unfortunately, it's just, you know, the higher character slavery. So even now, it's still hotly debated whether Afra Behn is an early abolitionist, exposing the violence of colonialism and slavery. But it's a story with many contradictory meanings and can be seen from many perspectives. Afra Behn is a dissident woman decrying the mistreatment of fellow human beings. But she's complicit in the system. Slavery was the business of the crown. Afra Behn is a lifelong royalist. Afra Behn supports her king, who supports the system of slavery. So it's very difficult. I read Orinoco as a critique of slavery. She never dwells on Orinoco's race, but instead on his royalty. She sees no way out. She seems horrified at the plight of what's happening to these people. And elsewhere, she compares the treatment of women to slavery. This is not something that she's picked up. It's just an isolated incident. Later on, much later, one of the prefaces to the play, I forget the name of the play, but a preface to one of the plays where they say that they were using Indian feathers that Afriben had brought back from Suriname. Probably so. Okay, so she was also a translator. She translated French philosophical texts into English, not the least of which was La Rochefoucauld's Maxims of 1664, which she translated from a 1674 edition. At the time, English readers only knew the Maxims from her translations, unless they, you know, spoke French. The thing I like best about it is that she modified some stuff, like changing masculine pronouns to feminine, or twisting the reflections to make her own proto-feminist points. Now, her fiction, plays, and poetry are filled with sexual politics and dark visions of the relationships between the sexes. This is not uncommon in Restoration comedies. You have two characters, two witty, wonderful characters, and they have some impediment to marriage. But it may be they have no money. It may be the guardians are against it. There are all kinds of things. And so they spend most of the play sparring wittily until they sort of devolve into commitment warily. Younger brothers had little hope of an income then that would attract an honorable woman. Upper-class women had little or no property rights. Inconstancy was rife. But in Ben's plays, the marriage plot is pretty complicated. Overbearing fathers and guardians, sometimes brother, overstep their control of the women in their lives. The honor of the good women characters is always in danger. There are constant threats to upper-class women whose freedom is restricted and whose honor is threatened, and to servant-class women who are fair game. But in Afriben, those attempted sexual assaults are repeatedly thwarted when would-be rapists are struck with impotence, or by the arrival of a good character who saves the woman from a terrible fate. So you don't see a lot of real violence in the comedies, in the Afriben comedies. But in an extreme case like Orinoco, the character kills the woman he loves to save her from a fate worse than death, from the loss of her honor. And in the comedies, though, the women devolve into their restricted roles. Experiencing an Afriben play or novel even now is a trip into ambiguity. One of the many reasons that reading her is so rewarding, because each reading offers a new meaning. Now, she died on April 16, 1689. As others have noted, she lies buried in Westminster Abbey. I wonder, though, if many have had the experience I had in searching for her grave when I was at Westminster Abbey. If you go to Poets' Corner, which I highly recommend, you walk all over and you're looking for Afriben, and you don't find her. So you have to go outside Poets' Corner, down some stone steps, into a dark, narrow hallway, like a cloister, and you step on her grave at the bottom of the stairs. Her gravestone is sunk into the stone floor in this little anteway. There aren't any flowers in sight, but you find her by stepping on her grave. So the next time you go to Westminster Abbey, please do what Virginia Woolf suggested in 1929. Please let some flowers fall on the grave of Afriben. But first you have to find it by inadvertently stepping on it. Its inscription on the gravestone: "Here lies proof that wit can never be defense against mortality." Thank you very much.
So I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that they're listening to Patty Lundberg speak about Afriben at the Commonwealth Club of California. And now it's time for questions. Who would like to ask the first one? Lee.
I became familiar with Afro-Ben when I was at UCLA, and I was living in London in 1984 and used to attend the Royal Court Theatre, where there was a series of revivals done by the really distinguished late British actor Anthony Quayle, and he revived Afro-Ben. And I had read her. I really don't enjoy, you know, reading plays. I prefer to see them performed. But his own great talents and the merits of these plays, I saw about three of them. They were really extraordinarily entertaining and popular and stimulating. So, I mean, she is not an antiquarian curiosity. I don't know if they are still reviving her work, but it certainly deserves revival.
I saw my first and only Afro-Ben play in 1989 at Chicago in at the Goodman Theater. And instead of setting it in Naples, they set it in the Caribbean. It's during Carnival, and that made good sense. It was absolutely delightful. Wit is the thing in this age. And just like when you read Shakespeare, it takes a little getting into the language, getting comfortable with the language again. It's that a little bit with Afro-Ben. And, of course, the plays are so much better if you see them produced than if you read them. But it's not a bad second choice to read them.
Exactly. Shakespeare is something else. But Restoration plays, aside from Dryden, really tend not to, to be too readable. And, certainly the proof is in the acting.
Jeremy Irons.
Could you maybe elaborate a little bit on her career as a spy? And did any of her adventures make their way into her plays or her writing in other ways?
Oh, gee. I haven't read all of her work. I don't recall any work of her being a spy. There is some suggestion by some scholars that she returned to being a spy in the 1680s. And so she was in her 40s. And when she went to Antwerp the first time, she was apparently commissioned to try to get William Scott, who she'd known in Suriname, to come back to the royalist cause. He'd been exiled as an anti-royalist. So there was apparently a reason for the crown to send her to try to reconcile William Scott and those people that were anti-royalists in Holland. But they were at war with the Dutch. So I don't personally recall any mention of the spying, except as people, I believe, decoded these letters from Agent 160 or Astrea. She often wrote poems as Astrea, but I don't think maybe somebody knows better than I about the spying.
Well, the English in both the 17th and the previous century were masters of spycraft, and to this day, part of the logs of Sir Francis Drake on his voyage around the world, and most of the archives left by Queen Elizabeth's spy master are still under the Official Secrets Act. Why I can't imagine, they were very good at it, and in the same way that here's this small island with a small really small population with enemies, very powerful enemies against it, prevailed by sheer brains and fortitude.
And apparently there are a lot of letters from her to the Crown saying, please pay me so I can come home. But...
keeping up a royal appearances after 300 years, huh?
I was wondering if there are any threads of literary influence between Bain and, say, Henry Fielding or John Cleland.
Well, let's see. When did Fielding publish Tom Jones? 1720s? I don't know of any. Her plays were produced through the 18th century until people like the 1862 literary garbage guy went after her and other plays. But she was well produced into, I'd say, 1860, 1870.
I think I missed something. You said she supported the royalists, the crown, who supported slavery, and yet she equated the role of women with slavery.
Right. I think she was quite conflicted.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And the thing about the novel Orinoco, which looks like an autobiography, is there are parts of it which are difficult to read. And it's impossible for me to think about this woman as a writer writing these things and contrasting the behavior of the English and the behavior of the English, the Indians, and the behavior of the slaves as the really good people and the English overseers and the English provincial government as being really awful. And untrustworthy, to say the least, and treacherous. So the fact that she depicted, first of all, that she experienced it, then that she depicted it, and then they put this on the stage along the way. I'm sure it was Baudelaireized, but it's amazing.
I came to Aphra Behn through Henry Purcell, being a musician. I came across, you know, these songs that were set from her plays. And also along the way in my adventures with Purcell, discovered his settings of some of the poetry of Catherine Phillips, who is a near contemporary. Mm-hmm. And even though she was obviously a rather different class, I'm wondering if Bain and Phillips ever did cross paths or whether they had any association at all.
I don't know. My life with Aphra Behn is quite limited.
Next question. So, on Aphra Behn, is she going to be covered at all this weekend?
Yes, thank you very much. So we're having this big two-day program starting tomorrow at Marines Memorial Theater on Restoration London. And on Saturday morning, we'll have Blair Hauksbee from Stanford University, who will be speaking about drama, not just the comedies, but drama in more particular and more general at the same time. And I begged him to please mention Aphra Behn in his abstract, and he promised he will mention her. I think he'll do more than that. But Blair Hauksbee from Stanford on Saturday morning.
So what else is covered in the program?
Well, tomorrow evening we have Bob Buchholz, who is setting the scene for Restoration London. Bob from Loyola University Chicago is of teaching company fame, and has done a lot of the great courses on Restoration London. He also is leading a tour for us in I think, May of 2014 to London, a walking tour and an underground tour to a lot of these historical places that date back to Restoration London. So he'll do that tomorrow night. And then we have the music of Henry Purcell tomorrow night. And on Saturday, art history and the drama, and That's tomorrow.
and the coffee house.
Oh, yes. And Bob, thank you. And Bob Buchholz will conclude the day Saturday afternoon with a lecture on plague and fire and the Royal Society and the rise of the coffee houses in England.
Yeah. It's a very interesting time because, you know, we talk about different periods of time where something came out of it. And the Merry Monarch and the plays and so on are all fairly common in a way. At different times, there's a popular culture, a sort of reaction against Puritanism. People don't think about it too often, but the Puritans that take over with Cromwell are not too much different than the Taliban, of today, that they come in and just try to shut everything down and no more pleasure. And, you know, after about 15 or 20 years of that, people tend to react, you know, by going overboard. And this is basically the time of Charles II. There obviously are differences from each time, but that's the reaction. Somebody makes everything great, maybe a better suggestion for that would be the Soviet Union. The Union made everything gray.
And on Saturday morning, we're going to have a lecture about that treacherous religious and political landscape with Tim Harris from Brown.
Okay. So, but I think the interesting thing about the time is that it also created the modern science. You know, in the middle of all that, right. Modern science. And this is kind of one of the things that I'm always interested in. Those of you who heard a lot of my lectures or the speakers that I bring in. A lot of people think, and maybe it was just my youth, but think that you need to organize everything and get everything in good shape so that something great can be created for human civilization. And at first you need to have everything orderly first. But nothing great that was ever created was ever created in anything but a mess. So you really don't need to do anything other than let the mess be there and then just, you know, crazy. I've heard several people say, well, when this happens, then I'll do something about it. There's no reason to wait, and there's, you know, if you do wait, there's nothing going to happen.
And Professor Buchholz has this really interesting perspective on how the coffee houses gave rise to this really burst of important things that happened in London and the rebuilding of London and the Charles II, when he could get out of the bedroom. He founded the Royal Society. I mean, he gave the charter for the Royal Society. And all of these wonderful people like Christopher Wren who rebuilt the churches after the big fire of 1666.
Of course. Now, why? How do you think, you know, like you start your reign? He started his reign in 1660. So 5 years after he started his reign, there's a fire that burned down 80% of London. And the year after that, there's a plague that destroys almost everything in 1667, and then the fire burns everything down in 1666. Now, those of you who are, you know, knowledgeable about religious numerology, 1666 drove the people crazy because they thought, you know, this is 666, and that's why, you know, we had this big fire because we had this merry monarch who was misbehaving. So, if everybody reacts that way, you know, and you're the leader, it's kind of a tough, you know, way to get started with your reign.
Perhaps it's worth pointing out that Greenwich Observatory, which was founded largely to solve the very burning issue of longitude determination, was inspired by Charles II's mistress, the Duchess of Kerwai, or Kerwall, as they called her in English, because there was a Breton astronomer who wanted the job. It turned out he didn't get it, but she did influence Charles to set up the observatory, and it had some very important consequences. And the other thing I might mention is that Alfred Bain was born just 2 years before Isaac Newton.
Another one. It's an amazing 25 years. So people argue over when the Restoration actually ended because there was all this turmoil after 1685 with the Glorious Revolution, the abdication of James. Technically, it ends in 1685, but there was so much happening beyond that. And she was there.
Well, I always like to make connections between different times and our time. And if you have somebody that is, you know, whispering in your ear, you know, I mean, Charles II doesn't look like the kind of person who would have started the Royal Observatory and, you know, the Royal Society and to give money for all that science. But, you know, we can think of plenty of people today, politicians today, who have done the same thing. I mean, Bill Clinton really wasn't set up to be the first president to balance the budget, you know, in a long time. That was not his ideal, but he had Robert Rubin speaking in his ear, and for some reason he heard him when he said that Wall Street runs things, and he actually did it for a couple of years. And that kind of thing happens all the time. And it's fascinating, as I said, you know, it's fascinating what gets done and how it gets done in the middle of a mess, and somebody with a really good idea moves forward.
Do you have a comment about that?
No. Okay.
Well, if we're going to make a comment, we have to make a comment about women's being outspoken and then giving up again. And there's certainly cyclic things about that.
In 1901, Lucas Mallet published a blockbuster called The History of Sir Richard Calmady. And she was already, you know, an important novelist, but they didn't know it was a woman. And so they, in 1901, the cat was out of the bag, and they discovered not only she was a woman, but she was a woman writing about things she shouldn't have been writing about, seduction. And not only that, she was the daughter of Charles Kingsley, Canon Charles Kingsley. So she scandalized the family, she scandalized London, and she left her husband, who was an Anglican priest. So she was vilified after that.
I just want to maybe interpret the previous comment a little bit differently. I would say that there are periods in time where women's voices are shut down rather than as a reactionary measure. I'm sure that's what you meant, as opposed to times when women are quiet. Because as we all know, we've experienced in our own lifetimes periods of activism and then the reactionary backlash, which threatens to swallow and move us backwards and has done so several times in my life.
In the 1680s sometime, and I forgot to write this down, Afrabin was arrested after having written and had delivered a preface. Prefaces before the plays were very common. Somebody would come out and make some kind of political statement, usually. And she was arrested after that for having somehow crossed the line. Even though she was a lifelong royalist, the crown didn't like what she said, and she was arrested for it.
I just have one very quick question. You said that Afra's Orinoco and probably some of her other works were critical of the English as characters. And so how does that fit into, A, her status in a royalist society, and B, the reception in the English society of those characters?
It's my understanding during Elizabethan times that politics was off limits on the stage, but that was not the case during the Restoration, and many of the plays had a layer of meaning that was political or overt. In her, it's overt. And because she was a royalist, and Charles was the royal, she was not, except for this one time she was arrested for the preface and was released, I think, the next day, she was not in trouble for writing these political statements because they supported the royals. In Love Letters Between a Nobleman and a Sister, the Philander character is anti-royalist, and he does not fare well in this novel. So her stance as a writer with her characters generally is pro-royal.
There's time for a couple more questions.
Let me just add about the Orinoco, the anti-English in the Orinoco. They were bad men. They were thugs in the Suriname society in which they were. It wasn't so much that they had slaves, which she found somewhat abhorrent. It was that they lied. They didn't follow through on their promises to the royal slave, and they couldn't be trusted. And they said they were going to let him go, and then they killed him. So it was these particular English that she was really opposed to.
Okay.
I'm always amused by the shame that the English carry about their revolution, the Cromwellian revolution. They're so upset that Charles' head was cut off.
Yeah.
And you just mentioned something that she put out, or one of the characters who was in fact an anti-royalist. Did you deal with the with Cromwell or the Puritans or the Roundheads in any other way? I mean, they were still around, not Cromwell, but the Roundheads were still around. The Puritans were certainly there. The political issues hadn't gone away entirely. So
whether she did that overtly, I can't say right now, but she certainly was doing it obliquely in all her plays, which were pro-sex, pro-women, pro-libertinism, that was pretty much against the Puritan way of life.
I'd say pretty much, yeah. So, to one of your questions a little bit earlier, when you talk about, you know, women's rights going up and down and so on, I think one of the things that we've discussed over the years at Humanities West as well is why does that take place? Why does tolerance increase and then decrease again? Does anybody have any ideas about that?
Because we're not enough outspoken.
Not enough outspoken. Okay. That's one. I don't think that's your issue. Right? But I think that that's the main issue from inside. But if you look at the society, what has caused greater tolerance and a shift at different times and what has not?
I think that when something is going well for a group, no matter what size, is that there's a tendency to believe that, okay, we've climbed the mountain and from now on we're on the plateau and we can keep it going. But the people who have been overcome in whatever their perspective is, are there building their resistance to that, and gradually they get enough strength and enough voice to take on the issue again, and so then there's some conflict, and sometimes they overcome.
That's a very interesting perspective on it too. I think from looking at it myself, it seems to me that when a society or a culture is very confident, that it develops more tolerance because the people feel they're in charge, they can allow other people to do what they want to without really upsetting them. And the U.S. Culture after World War II was a very confident culture, although it was a very intolerant culture all the way up there and afterwards. And then as each thing came along, you know, there was women's rights, there was African-American rights, civil rights, and it just kept rolling along, and there were gay rights. There was an expansion of this because of our confidence. If you look at Islamic culture 100 years after they started, there suddenly was more tolerance than usual because they felt, well, gee, you know, in that 100 years, we took over the whole Mediterranean, and we're on top of the world, and we must have the right ideas to be in charge of everything. There's maybe no logic between that, but we are in charge, and therefore they went out and wanted to collect all the wisdom from all over the world in a couple of places and study it. Now, not a lot of people, but some people, and it was accepted behavior by the powers that be, and you can look at parts of British history where they felt on top, that they were a little bit more tolerant. And the reason I think that that's a useful thing to know is that, you know, that tolerance is something that goes away when cultural confidence decreases. And it's a very important as an element for increasing our tolerance and keeping our tolerance to make sure that we're culturally confident as well.
Of course, a good counterexample to that is the USSR. I would say it's quite intolerant, just when it was very powerful.
But was it confident? There's a difference between power and confidence.
I don't know. They thought they were going to win. Khrushchev said, "We will bury you."
That's just like when Yale says, "We're just as good as Harvard." I mean, as a feeling, you know, that's a long term, you know, thing that people always do. We're in second place. If you study the Soviet Union and how confident they were, they felt that they were, you know, Russia's always felt sort of problematic in their relationship with Europe. So, but yeah, they certainly were powerful, and yes, they were very intolerant. Any last point? There's time for one more comment.
I think your point about confidence is interesting, but I would approach it from a different perspective, which is that underpinning most societies and social structures and cultures is, in fact, power, after all. And so when social change threatens let's say, those who hold power in any society to a point where it's actually threatening, unless that revolution, let's call it, has in fact occurred so that the status quo has indeed unalterably been changed at its base, those who hold the power, that's the backlash. They actually are still in place. The power has not been adequately challenged. And so the necessity is to become conservative again.
That's a great way to end.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club of California in its 110th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you all for coming.